You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to Times Higher Education's books podcast. In our latest edition, I am delighted and honoured to have as my guest David Marquand, who is here to talk about his new book, Mammon's Kingdom, an essay on Britain now. David needs no introduction, I should perhaps argue. Politician, leader writer for The Guardian at the age of 25 when it was the Manchester Guardian, Labour MP from 1966 to 1977, and eminent historian and perhaps the political conscience of the nation. Is that hyperbole?
Yes. Certainly hyperbole, but it's very nice hyperbole. I like the last bit particularly.
This book speaks of a profound crisis of our moral economy, our public culture and our democracy. Things are bad, it seems, when reading this book, and things are particularly bad in Britain. Now, did you think you wouldn't be thanked for saying the bad things that are happening are particularly nasty here?
Well, I thought that some people would object strongly, which indeed they have, and that some people would say, yeah, that's just about it, which some people have said. So the reviews have been mixed. The best one was by Rowan Williams, which was absolutely wonderful in The New Statesman. I won't tell you which was the worst one, but actually a very good one was in your paper by Danny Dorling. Excellent. I say in the book, at the beginning, in the introduction, that this is meant to be a wake-up call. And that is how I see it. And of course, if you give people a wake-up call, some people, actually in the real world, like me, just put their head beneath the blankets and don't do anything. Other people do get up. And that was the object of the exercise.
It's a very short book. It could have been, I should imagine, much longer, particularly given the people you were discussing, the political and intellectual history. A lot could be said about Edmund Burke, a lot could be said about Amartya Sen. And it seemed to me that it must have been a conscious decision to say, right, I'm going to keep it to about 200 pages, go for these points, and end with a very ringing conclusion.
Well, the publishers... It's a long and complicated story. I won't bore you with it or your listeners. But anyway, the gist of it is that when I was given the contract by Penguin Books, they wanted me to do it in a year. Actually, it took a little bit longer than that. It was really more like 18 months from starting to write to the final version going off to them. But that was a very short time, actually, and a longer... Yes, there were many places where it would have been nice to have gone into more detail. But, that was a time constraint. And actually, in a way, I think it was probably beneficial, because I think if I'd had more time, it wouldn't have been quite so taut. And I think it does have a certain punchiness, which would have probably not been there had it been a much longer book.
Now, as the title suggests, with that evocative word mammon in it and the quite no-holds-barred beginning, talking about the worship of money, it struck me that the deadly sin of this book must surely have been avarice. And, of course, there are many things that suggest that that is the case. But when I look at the conclusion of the book, and you mentioned the Welsh hymn whose name I will not attempt to pronounce.
Cwm Rhondda.
Thank you very much. I am weak, but thou art mighty. You talk about us being puffed up by indecent pride. So is pride the real sin?
I think they go together. I think money worship and, I mean, pride in acquisition. I mean, the people who don't acquire, of course, don't feel proud. And that's part of the problem. They feel humiliated. But the people at the top, I think, do feel proud just because they're so rich.
The flaming Ferraris,
yes. They, and of course they want to be richer still. That's the other thing. And it's a constant push. The 1%, the top 1% of the top 1%. You know, what makes them want to get more still?
That it's never enough. That the bankers, some of whom you so memorably describe, you would think that earning a few million or a few million more would be enough, but it appears not to be.
Well, I think one of the things I do say in the book, actually, and sadly nobody's quite picked this up, is that they lead the very rich and the very, very rich lead a very extraordinary lives, not at all happy lives, really, because they're part of an international community.
Right, so they could do what they do in Singapore as well as in London.
Exactly, but also their comparators are part of this international super rich. They're not tied to the country where they live or whose passports they carry, for the most part. They are part of this very strange, egoistic, but also insecure, is my reading of it. Hmm. Insecure world. They've acquired a lot, but they could lose it.
The rootlessness, the figures on screens, the fortunes made and lost.
That's
instantly.
Right. Yes, that's
and
right.
This idea of wealth being congealed. Now I've forgotten the term.
Congealed income.
Congealed income.
Yeah.
You say that you were lucky to grow up in Attlee's austere but hopeful Britain. We hear the word austerity now in reference to our own age. Is it the same kind of austerity, and is it hopeful?
It's not the same kind of austerity at all. I mean, Attlee's Britain had just, after 6 years of total war, in which there really was, for a time, a real possibility that Britain would be completely destroyed. It was a touch and go at the beginning. Everything was rationed, etc., etc. That remained true in Attlee's Britain as well. In fact, in some ways, austerity was greater immediately after the war than it was during the war. For example, bread was never rationed during the war. It was rationed for a brief period under the Attlee government.
So are you offended when austerity is used as a kind of, well, we're all in this together, belt-tightening, good old days phrase to make us feel good about what's going on?
Well, it's better than the Dunkirk spirit, which is another way. I think that's gone out now of political jargon. But it used to be quite widespread. I mean, Harold Wilson was forever talking about the Dunkirk spirit. Actually, of course, as Churchill pointed out at the time, Dunkirk was a very serious defeat.
Yes. Do you think that the sense of austerity we're dealing with now is so much humbug being used to make people feel slightly better about things getting much tougher at the bottom? And of course, in the previous age of austerity, the Gini coefficient was much different to what it is now.
Yes. Yes, I couldn't find figures for the very early period, but yes, it certainly was. I think life for the bottom fifth, poorest fifth in this country, there's just been a new report out yesterday by the High Pay Commission, which shows that the poorest fifth in this country are poorer than the poorest fifth in all the large sort of mature democracies of Western Europe. You have to go to the ex-communist countries to find a comparable position. So for the poorest, it really is austere, at least in terms of the recent past. And I guess you're right, yes. It's a way of saying, well, you know, tighten your belts, we're all tightening our belts, which isn't noticeably true of large parts of the top super rich. They're not tightening their belts at all, as far as I can see. And one of the things which I quote, actually, in the book, which I found very, very startling, is by a very dear friend of mine, Robert Skidelsky, wrote this, that what has happened in the period during and since the crisis is asset prices have risen, real wages have fallen. And put those things together, asset prices have risen. The housing market in London is completely insane now. Those people shouldn't be feeling, aren't belt tightening, on the contrary. But at the bottom, yes, real wages going down.
Economics comes in your sights. You identified the physics envy in economists some decades ago, the idea that there was some kind of untouchable, value-free secret science that could be discovered. And you also use the term a form of disciplinary lobotomy. Of course, there are heterodox economists. There are quite a lot of economists who apparently saw the crisis coming, although you point out that Vince Cable and only a few other people actually had. Do you see any hope that people are, whether it's undergraduates who are looking for economics courses with a broader range of non-neoclassical economics, or academics in general, or the public in general, are we more skeptical of economists now?
Well, what I think, my wife is an economist, and I've learned a lot from her on this matter. What I think I've seen is a sort of bifurcation amongst people who've studied economics at university. Some get sort of sucked in to the beauties of this subject, and in a way they do have a sort of tunnel vision.
The cult, but, the crossword puzzle doing.
Yeah, but some, and they seem to me, from my experience, to include actually some of the best and brightest, don't want to go into academic economics. They go into think tanks, they do all sorts of things, they become journalists, they do, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But they don't want to be, they don't want to sacrifice breadth for the sake of this absolutely physics envy sort of work. When I was at Sheffield University a while ago, I and a couple of other people set up a little research centre, which we call the Political Economy Research Centre, right? And the best graduate student we had was a young man who had got a very good first from his, I think it was, I can't remember which university it was, I think it might have been Edinburgh. But anyway, he produced a very, very good dissertation, and then he went off and he ended up working in Gordon Brown's office when Brown was Prime Minister, in quite an influential position. He's now set up a think tank whose name I forget.
You say good capitalism is impossible without good people living good lives. In a culture suffused with hedonistic individualism, the very notion of a good life is problematic. You also detail how all of us are to blame. House owners who gambled on ever-rising house prices, credit card holders who borrowed more than they could realistically ever expect to pay back, voters thought they were entitled to ever-rising living standards, exorbitant private debt. So, obviously, the moral theme of the book clearly gains its force from not just saying, oh, look at those awful bankers, but saying it is all of us as a society. I would say to you that some people might argue, if I am badly paid, if I have to work in London for my job, even if I'm immune to the blandishments of the consumer society that is apparently so important that when purchasing on the high street drops, we're all meant to be worried, people's personal debt rises when their income is not sufficient to meet their outgoings. Is that not true? It's not just all of us getting those fabled 60-inch television screens, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. Clearly so. What is particularly worrying about the present situation in this country is that that's all happening now. I mean, the household debt is increasing quite dramatically, and we have a house price boom, which is very reminiscent of what was happening just before the crash. In fact, I was talking to somebody last night about what happens if we don't change, because the very last sentence of the book is we can't go on as we are. And what happens if we do go on as we are? Well, I think what happens if we do go on as we are is that we'll have another crash, and possibly quite soon. And I noticed that Gordon Brown is saying that too. He should know.
Yes. When you cast your argument in moral terms, which I think is quite brave, apologies if that sounds enormously condescending to you to say, how brave of you to be moral, David. When you cast it in that terms, do you not immediately get filed with Rowan Williams? Do you not immediately get filed with admirable men who are saying things possibly about God? You do obviously say you are not yourself religious, but you mention the many valuable things from the Abrahamic traditions and others. As soon as you start saying it's about being a good person, people put their hands over their ears and think, ah, we need someone to tell us a solution about this that doesn't involve anything about goodness, because that's just, well, that's all very well and good, but it's really for Sunday.
Yeah, I think that's right. But mind you, on reflection, perhaps I should have toned down some of these passages. In a way, I'm glad I didn't, because I think that makes the book sort of more punchy. But I'm not claiming to be a good person. I don't think I'm any better than anybody else. But I do think that you need to have a moral compass, to use a slightly corny word. In fact, I don't think you can really live as a human being without some kind of moral compass. You've got some way of, you know, knowing this is right, this is wrong. In the book, one of the points I make is what I call the moral economy is in crisis. What I mean by the moral economy, this is an idea that was in fact invented by great historian E.P. Thompson, and he uses it to describe the bread riots of the late 18th century. Now, my take on the moral economy is that it's a set of assumptions, attitudes, precepts, etc., which tell economic agents how they ought to behave. And in the period immediately before the crash, we had what I call in the book a market fundamentalist moral economy, which told economic actors to behave in the way that we saw them behaving in the period up to the crash. That moral economy, the market fundamentalist moral economy, because of the crash and in the period leading up to the crash, was in crisis. And that crisis, I believe, has not been resolved yet. And part of the last chapter, purpose of the last chapter of the book, is to suggest that we should resolve it. And the only way we can resolve it is by having a very deep national debate about where we are going and where we ought to be going. And that's what I was trying to stimulate, really, in that last chapter.
Now, the national conversation, I would assume, would be one in which looking at people who've had important things to say, many of whom you mentioned, whether it's Burke or Michael Sandel talking about public discourse being empty of moral and spiritual substance, or the fact that there are two Adam Smiths and one often gets forgotten, the Wealth of Nations chap and the Theory of Moral Sentiments chap, and the second one is often overlooked. The kind of conversation I like to imagine that one might have in an Oxford tutorial with intelligent people thinking hard about things, leaving everything open to discussion, and that maybe in microcosm, that's what would happen in a seminar room in a place of higher education where it's not just an instrumentalist degree getting, but a place to become a better person. So what I would put to you is, if am I right that that kind of small conversation is a model for what could happen elsewhere, maybe not with so many footnotes, but then why do so many people who've been to Oxford and done degrees in PPE gone on to make life so unpleasant and horrid for the rest of us? If they had all these lovely conversations, why are the Eton and Oxford graduates presiding over such an unequal society?
I don't think I see the conversation in really in that way. I think it's very interesting at the moment to look at what is happening, clearly happening in Scotland. I think that is a very profound national conversation is going on. Who are we? Where do we belong? Should we be part of the United Kingdom, which we voluntarily joined as a result of a bargain with England back in the beginning of the 18th century, or should we now become an independent country, which we were before 1707? That debate is very profound, and it's certainly not confined to, Oxbridge graduates. It's not confined to graduates of Edinburgh University either. It's nationwide. And indeed, in the period before devolution in Scotland, there was the Scottish Constitutional Convention, it was called, which drew people from all walks of life and all parts of the political spectrum. And that was why devolution came actually when it did. It became an irresistible demand. In Wales, which I know better than I know Scotland, I noticed the same thing is now beginning to happen. It's not quite as vociferous, and the issues involved are not put in quite the same stark way. But there is very definitely a national conversation going on in Wales about who are we? Who are the Welsh? What should their relationship be to the rest of the United Kingdom? How can we make the best of a small and rather poor, in European terms, country? And that both of those national conversations are very, very alive, and they're certainly not confined to university graduates. They go right across civil society. Now, that's the sort of thing that I'm calling for. I don't think there's much of that in England. There might be. It
what
might
is
come.
The national conversation in England besides about immigrants being a threat?
Well, I think there is some interesting things are happening, I think, in England. It's very hard to suss them out. But I do notice that, for example, St. George's flags proliferating when there are football matches and things like that, occasions when it seems appropriate to do so. There's a campaign for an English Parliament going on right now,
yes.
On the web mainly. Now, I don't know who all the people are who sign up to that. I suspect that some of them are pretty UKIP-ish, but I don't think they all are by any manner of means at all. So I think there is the sort of tentative beginnings of a national conversation. Unfortunately, it does not yet, and nor do the Welsh and Scottish ones, it does not yet embrace all the issues that I was trying to discuss in Mammon's Kingdom. But, you know, it's a beginning. And the other thing is that, rather sadly, none of the people who have reviewed the book have picked up on a point that I make in the last chapter, where I talk about groups of people who are challenging
38 Degrees, Open Democracy,
that's right.
Avaaz, Citizens
yeah.
UK, the Green
yeah.
Party.
All of that, all of this.
Grounds for Hope.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. And the people who've flocked into these movements, sometimes, you know, they're very naive, they, you know, and so on. But they want to see a better country and a better world. And they're working. I mean, the task is really to bring them all together. Because at the moment, they're all a bit
disparate.
Sort of disparate. And I mean, for example, I mentioned women's institutes,
yes.
which was rather teased by the reviewer in The Guardian. But it is important. They're very disparate, and they probably don't communicate very much with each other. And that's
but they are communitarian in spirit.
They're communitarian in spirit, and they are carrying out a sort of conversation, the beginnings of a national conversation, I think.
Of course, a national conversation will perforce involve the media, and you've pointed out in this book that the media don't cover themselves in glory in terms of understanding what the economic, what Britain's present discontents that hold sway in business schools, middlebrow periodicals, right-leaning think tanks, and most of the political class. So the media are lumped in with that, and of course there are the interests of media ownership that mean that dissenting voices rarely get a hearing, and we see the impetus to have a clearly defined opposing view that gave so much prominence to UKIP in certain outlets because it was clearly definable. So are you not going to be hampered in pursuit of a national conversation by what I take you see as a quite flawed media? And I would also say, isn't the media as flawed as it is better than nothing? What about the expenses scandal? Maybe that was done to sell newspapers, but gosh, there's got to be someone keeping an eye on things, and that estate of journalists are, as flawed as they are, perhaps better than if we didn't have them.
Oh, yes, I agree with that. But I also think that one of the changes which have taken place, well, certainly in my lifetime, but even in the last few years, which I didn't say enough about in the book, I must admit, and people who have criticised me for not saying enough are right, and that is that particularly with young people, I don't think they take much notice of the print media.
Yes.
There's such an immense amount of stuff on the web that you can get, and the internet journal Open Democracy, which I mentioned, yes. is one, but there are a whole load of others, and I'm sure you must be the same as me. Every day I look at my emails. There's more stuff coming from all sorts of different people. some of it is pretty rubbishy, but some of it's not rubbishy at all.
Genuinely valuable. The Everyday Sexism campaign, for example. And the campaign to put a woman on a banknote. A lot of those were, you know, driven in part or facilitated by social media.
Sure.
So that must also be grounds for hope. And, of course, 38 Degrees.
Well, 38 Degrees has an excellent record, I think, and admire very much the guy who runs it, whom I met about a year ago, David Babbs. But Avaaz, too. And these bodies, I mean, one shouldn't sort of regard them as a substitute for what I call a national conversation, but they are actually facilitating a conversation of a sort. And I think that's very important. As you mentioned Amartya Sen, and indeed, Amartya Sen is one of my heroes. And his emphasis that he places on public reasoning, what he calls public reasoning, as being the essence of democracy, not formal institutions. You need formal institutions, but without public reasoning, they won't amount to much. And I think that's absolutely right. And what we need in this country, among other things, is spaces where public reasoning can take place. The internet and so on is better than nothing, but it's not quite enough. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, I would like to see much more powerful local governments.
Certainly, because when we see public reasoning as done by our elected representatives in PMQs or in Parliament, it's deeply distressing.
Yes, it's absolutely...
Boys shouting at each other.
It's absolutely ghastly.
What was your feeling coming as a politically engaged person who had spent, I presume, a lot of time when you were an undergraduate and beyond learning how to debate and think, to be put into this bear pit where, I suppose then, they were better dressed and better spoken, but just sort of shouting imprecations at each other?
Well, actually, it depends what you mean by better spoken. There are far more working class people
right.
there then than there are now.
Yes, Labour seems to have
sure.
But, gotten rid of them.
But the bear garden wasn't quite as bearish as it is now, but it could still be pretty bearish. But on the other hand, you see, one of the things that's happened in Parliament, in the House of Commons, is an enormously increased role for select committees.
Yes.
And now these committees, which were very, very... I mean, they existed in my day, but there weren't nearly so many of them, and they were really pretty toothless. They're not toothless now, as Rupert Murdoch discovered to his cost, actually, when he was interrogated by the... I forget what it's called, the Media and Sports or whatever it is committee. And so... and that, I think, is where now the public reasoning, if you like, of Parliament takes place. And one of the things I'd like to know, but I don't know, is who are the people who are doing the shouting and screaming at Prime Minister's questions? Are they the same as the people who are behaving very seriously and very good-spirited way in select committees? I suspect they're different. I suspect
yes.
there are two classes of MPs. There are those who do the solid graft in committees and do it very well now, very, very well in some cases. And then there's this other lot who shout and scream.
And is that just a display because there are television cameras and because they are...
Yes. I mean, when I was an MP, I was very much in favour of televising the House of Commons.
It's not an edifying spectacle.
It is not an edifying spectacle at all. And I think experience has proved it was a bad idea. On the other hand, Dick Crossman, who was a leader of the House of Commons for a period in the Wilson government, always used to say, to make the committees really effective, as they are in the United States, they need to be televised. So funnily enough, I would televise. They are televised. You can get them now. There's a whole channel. I applaud that. And, well, maybe the silly public schoolboys, and they're not all public schoolboys either, by the way, shouting and yelling are the price we pay for that.
Who do you admire in Parliament at the moment, or politics generally?
Politics generally?
Hmm.
Well, one of the people I admire enormously is... Tony Wright, who was an exact... I think he's now left the Commons, but he went in there, very bright guy, and he deliberately chose to pursue a career as the chairman of a select committee rather than aim for ministerial office. And he created, really, I think it's called the Public Administration Committee,
right.
And that became a very, very important tool of delving into the hidden secrets of the executive. Another person whom I admire very much who's there now is Margaret Hodge, who's chairman of the Public Accounts Committee, which is a very venerable committee that was actually set up by Gladstone in the 19th century. She has produced some superb work and exposed, you know, all kinds of nasty goings on on the part of the sort of nexus between the executive and rather dodgy financial institutions. She was the person who's just recently came out with the really shameful figures about the amount of money that Amazon makes in this country compared to the amount of tax it pays, because of course it's domiciled theoretically in Luxembourg.
Which gives every author pause for thought, doesn't it, when you think that like so many corporations that one does not admire and fears is not helping the nation, that there is almost no alternative but to deal with them. No author would willingly, you know, cut off 60% of their sales. Now,
I wouldn't mind them paying some tax, though.
Yes,
I wouldn't object to that.
I'd like to ask you about your comments in the book about higher education and tuition fees, and especially the Brown Review, which we wrote about quite a lot. And of course, we know that was partially implemented, although the argument of the people on the review was that it was not implemented as they wished. And had it been done so, perhaps it would have all been marvellous. Do you think £9,000 tuition fees are a bad idea?
Yes, I certainly do.
But you don't have to pay it back, David, until you're employed. It's all fine.
People
don't know that.
Don't
worry about that.
People don't know that, actually. It depends what sort of class the kid comes from, the young person yes. comes from. I think it's ludicrously high.
You can just tack it onto your debt when you're trying to buy a £1 million one-bedroom flat 10 years from now.
Well, perhaps you ought to go and live somewhere else where flats are not as expensive as that. No, I think it was an absolutely shameful report. I think what then happened, of course, is that in a way, the Brown Review are right, that what they were proposing was a completely free market
yes.
in higher education. That's not what's happened, of course. No, quite true. And then there was the question of how you should pay for higher education, and what you've got is a very peculiar, as I understand it, very peculiar mixture of a graduate tax and a loan, which
can be sold off, the loan book being sold off to private interests. And
that's not a very attractive prospect, is it?
As though someone says, well, we're going to give you a loan, we can't tell you who's lending it to you or how much it will cost. It's it's quite alarming, isn't it?
Sure.
And it turns out that the taxpayer will not save any money at the end of it.
So the whole thing is absolutely cracking up under its own weight, I think.
What about the argument that's so often piously trotted out? I'm revealing my view, but the idea that, well, previously, you know, the dustman was paying for peers' children to go to Oxbridge when education was free. So that was a terrible thing. So, and just as when people say the fuel discount, well, when you means test things, that's much fairer. But as I believe you discuss in the book, the point about the dole not being means tested but universal benefits meant that a few people got it who didn't need it, but far more people who might not have applied for it did get what they needed.
That's the beverage system,
yes,
essentially.
Yes,
yes, yes, I think that's
and
right.
Would you argue the same is true for higher education?
I would argue it in a way a different point. The taxation system has to be looked at as a whole. Yes, of course. We also, all taxpayers pay for roads. And they pay for, you could say, that we are paying for very obnoxious ultra-rich people to go screaming along the motorway in 4x4s. Taxes are levied, and then expenditure comes from the revenue that the taxes are levied. And if you once get into the business of trying to, as it were, allocate each bit of spending to each tax, you end up in an absolute nightmare, I think, of complexity. You have to look at it as a whole, and you have to decide as a whole whether the taxation system should be regressive or progressive, or, you know, where it should be on the spectrum between real progressive and real regressive. That has to be a decision, in our system, that has to be a decision for the government and parliament. But don't start fussing about each little particular bit of spending in the way that people who make that point are doing.
So should there be tuition fees?
I think, and this is a point that I actually cribbed from my wife, if you want to know, because she's really an expert in all this, I argued in the book that, in fact, the Brown Review treated higher education as though it was a private good, although there are bits, I mean, it's a very peculiar review, because it turns out that medicine and various kinds of very difficult languages suddenly turn out not to be private goods. They turn out to be public goods of a sort. The fact is that they're both private and public. And so it's reasonable that there should be some contribution, I think, from students, as it were, in respect of the private part. But it's perfectly reasonable for the state to pay for the public part.
Do you think that...
How you do that in detail, I don't think you can. I mean, I don't think there's a philosopher's stone that's going to tell you exactly how much tuition fees should be.
Right.
But after all...
Should the market decide?
Well...
Should Oxford and Cambridge be allowed to become private institutions and charge what they will?
It would be, actually, a disaster for them to do that. When I was running a very small and poor college in Oxford a few years back, there was a lot of talk about we should privatise ourselves. And what the talkers didn't factor in was, number one, we have an enormously expensive medical school. Number two, we have really high-powered, very expensive physics, for example, in some of the pure sciences are very, very costly. And what we would be if Oxford privatised itself and decided to fix a fee that covered the whole cost of the university, apart from endowments, of course, it would become a sort of finishing school for rich white trash from all over the world. That's what it would become.
Like Caribbean medical schools.
Yeah. And I don't think any serious person on the staff of Oxford University wants it to go in that direction. What it is doing instead is a bit, in a way, not all that attractive, but it's the only thing you can do.
Pursuing.
Massive, massive pursuit of donations.
Right. And having to shill. Did you have to shill? Did you have to go to dinners with wealthy people?
There wasn't much point in Mansfield. We didn't know any wealthy people. We were the subject of a sort of scam by some journalists who were alleging in some complicated way that we were selling degrees. We weren't. But we had one rich donor who was one rich alumnus who gave us, actually gave me a cheque for £2 million at one point, which I had to carry back to college in my inside pocket. I was really scared. I said, look, supposing it falls out and I lose it. And he said, don't worry, nobody else can cash it. But I mean, that was a one-off. It's gone beyond now. It's far, far more intensive than it was when I was there.
But how does this feed into inequality? Obviously, people are spending time and money running after people who may be varying degrees of savoury or unsavoury, as perhaps some other London-based institutions have discovered. But really, maybe it's just something that has to be done.
Well, it is.
How will that affect the integrity of the institution? We will take their money, but we won't do anything awful. You know that, don't you?
I'm not sure, but I think there have been some rather remarkable donations. For example, the Blavatsky School of Government exists now. That is really charging the same sort of fees to people who study there as MIT or Harvard or whoever. It's not cheap. I'm a bit sad, actually, because what I think is happening is Oxford and Cambridge are both, if you like, internationalising themselves, and not in relation to Europe, but in relation to the other side of the Atlantic. And the whole university system, of course, is getting more and more fragmented and differentiated with all sorts of different groups, the Russell group and the this group and the that group and so on. And the one of the basic ideals of the British university system, I mean, I taught in some very different institutions,
Salford,
Sussex, you know, Oxford, you name, and also at Berkeley as a very, very junior member of the staff. The ideal of British higher education in the days when I was really part of it was that a degree from one place would be equal to a degree from another place. And one of the reasons, that's why we had external examiners, you know,
yes,
to make sure that the standards were more or less similar across the board. We've still got that, I think, but I'm not sure. So it is different from America, as I understand it.
Yes.
Everybody knows Harvard is not the University of Podunk.
Yes.
But here, we don't have a Harvard and we don't have Podunk either, you know. How long that can stand up to this increasing differentiation in, you know, on the ground, I don't know. I would be very sad if it didn't stand up.
Many people have argued, of course, that the Labour Party's objective at one point to increase participation to 50%, the changing of polytechnics into universities. We hear many comments from people who presumably didn't go to post-92 universities who say, whoever knew there was a University of Bolton? Snobbery from people who would say that higher education is such an important good in making you a better person. But there's a lot of... It seems to me that it's class-based. The suggestion is that's where the lower orders go, and Salford must be, well, Salford, who knew, a university? What do they need one for?
Yeah. When I got the job at Salford, a friend of mine who is a fellow of All Souls said, "That's, you're scraping the barrel, aren't you?" And, but, you know, and various other friends were rather surprised too that I should go, "Oh, what do you want to go to there for?
You had such a bright career ahead of you."
Yeah,
what are you doing?
Really. But
do you think too many people are going to university? That's certainly the view of...
No, I do not.
But surely they're not as able as when only 4% went, when bright grammar school boys could be plucked from working class obscurity and do well.
I think they are. I mean, I think it was Kingsley Amis, I think, who invented this slogan, "More means worse."
Yes.
It didn't mean worse. And I think the most remarkable proof that it doesn't mean worse is the greatest experiment in higher education in this country, the most remarkable in the world, namely the Open University. And the Open University takes all sorts of people, and it's an incredibly impressive institution. I worked as an external examiner in it for a brief period once. My wife has a degree from the Open University, a postgraduate degree, and our daughter has a degree from the Open University as well. And it is a remarkable institution, I think it proves that the talent that is out there is much greater than the people who assume more means worse are thinking. And another aspect of this whole thing that I find very, very interesting and very worrying is it does seem as if the particular demographic which does worst are white working class boys. Now, why should that be? Why should white working class boys do worse than white working class girls? And why should white working class boys do worse than coloured working class boys? There's a big question mark there, and it's clearly not, I think, a matter of them being thick. There's something else has to be dug into to find out the answer to that question. What does it take for them to realise their potential? This is one of the things that Gordon Brown used to bang on about, the importance of potential, realising potential.
The first Prime Minister with a doctorate, interestingly.
Is he?
Yes.
That's very interesting. I used to know Gordon Brown a bit, and talking to him, sort of tête-à-tête, was rather like going to a tutorial with a rather irascible tutor, even though he's much younger than me. Because what he would say was, "Have you read this? Have you read that? Have you read this?" And I realised quite early on that it would be better to say no if the answer was no. Because if you said yes, then he would start to examine you on it. Now, he's a very remarkable man. I didn't... he probably is the only one with a doctorate. Interesting.
Your description of Tony Blair in the book, I think, resonates possibly with many readers. Had you always had that view of him?
No. No. When he was elected leader of the Labour Party, I was overjoyed. And when he made his very brave campaign to change the famous Clause 4 of the Labour Party Constitution that committed it to public ownership of the means of distribution, production, distribution, and exchange, and put a much better clause, I thought this was terrific. Very brave, and I admired him for that. And actually, for most of his first term, I admired very much the Human Rights Act. I admired very much the Belfast Agreement, which I think was not only achieved by him, of course. He was building on achievements before by Major and also by the cooperation of the Dublin government. All sorts of things fed into that. But nevertheless, it was he who actually did it. And it was he as well who carried through the devolution legislation and actually the very, very, I think, healthy and remarkable change of having a directed mayor of London. So this was the first term. He went to the bad in the second term because he fell in love with George Bush, which is bizarre. And then after that, it seemed to me that the government really did slip into a most awful period of, you know, anti-terror legislation, which was curbing civil liberties in the most dreadful way. And then there's all this stuff about rendition and torture, you know. It was a sorry story. The last part of the Blair regime was a very, very sorry story. And unfortunately, it doesn't look as though we're going to get the full story from the Chilcot inquiry either, which is a pity. More than a pity, it's a scandal.
And at the same time, it was a government that was immensely relaxed about people getting filthy rich.
Well, that was what Peter Mandelson said. Yes. Well, I said that, I quote that in the very first paragraph. Yes, there's something in the...
Money and filth.
Money and feces, feces, I say. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
That was a very memorable line. Now, you say the greatest obstacles to a decent capitalism, and spend some time talking about the idea of decency, are in our minds. Do you think our minds are up to the challenge of being decent and making capitalism decent?
Well, yes, I do think so. But I think the question is whether we want to. That's what I mean by being in our minds. Do we really want to? And are we prepared for the hard graft that would be necessary in order to do it? And the only answer to that is I don't know. But I think there are hopeful signs, as I said earlier on. There are a lot of people out there who do want to do this. The task is to knit them together.
David, thank you so much for joining me.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.